My guest at this time is Andy Roth. He is the Vice President of Government Affairs at the Club for Growth. He joins me now to explain why the Club for Growth was strongly opposed to the nearly $1.1 trillion omnibus bill that easily passed both the House and Senate. We'll also go through some of the arguments for the bill and why the Club for Growth does not think those are legitimate reasons to back the legislation. And Andy, it's good to have you with us. Thank you.
Hi, thanks for having me, Greg.
To say that this is a vote that you're going to score on means that you believe there's a strong reason to either support or oppose it, in this case, oppose it. Why do you believe that this was a bill that could not be supported?
Well, mainly because it's Congress basically breaking their pledge from 2011. As your listeners may know, in that year, they raised the debt ceiling in exchange for a lot of spending cuts. In those intervening years between 2011 and 2014, those spending cuts apparently were too unbearable for a lot of members of Congress. So this deal is the product of the Ryan-Murray deal that occurred in December, where they decided to get rid of part of those spending cuts so that they could increase spending immediately. And that's what this budget is.
And does that mean that as we head towards another debt ceiling debate in a couple of months or so, that this is a lack of leverage now on the part of Republicans and conservatives going forward?
Well, I think that's a separate issue. But I think at the end of the day, the answer is yes. The Republicans have lost a lot of leverage, both with their own base and with the general public when it comes to cutting spending or at least tightening the fiscal belt in Washington. I don't think that they're as believable as they once were.
Andy, we talked to one House Republican earlier in the week, and he was one who ended up supporting the bill, and he said the reasons for doing so, because he said there were cuts to EPA, the IRS, the Independent Payment Advisory Board, even Obamacare dollars themselves, and in a lot of ways rolling back spending levels to the end of the Bush years, which I know you weren't all that impressed with, but he says it's in the right direction, even though everything in the bill is not perfect. How would you counter that?
Well, see, that's where it gets it wrong. It's not in the right direction, because had we stuck to the spending cuts that we promised voters in 2011, that bill that just passed would have been even smaller, and it would have reduced the deficit even more. It is true that it is small relative to previous years, but that means that it's because we've been successful at keeping the belt tight. What they're doing now is unwinding that belt. And it may seem like just a small little increase in spending now, but this is all set up so that they can spend even more money in the year after next and the year after that. So I think whoever that was is misguided, because they're not looking at the trend that is occurring. And the trend is not cutting even more money, it's spending even more money.
How alarmed were you by the margins? Just 67, I believe, opposed it in the House and 26 in the Senate.
Well, we take kind of a cynical view of the politicians in Washington, and I suspect at the end of the day, there probably only are about 67, if we're lucky, maybe 80 or even 100, who are true committed fiscal conservatives in the House. I think the other Republicans who don't fall in that category vote with us from time to time, but they're certainly not reliable day to day.
What's your general assessment of Paul Ryan, the House Budget Chairman? He's largely been lauded on the right as the one who understands the budget well and has the smart approach, and he's obviously the one who engineered this bipartisan deal with Patty Murray. So where does he stand in the group's estimation right now?
Well, we've never made it a secret that Paul Ryan is a very smart man who probably does know the budget better than anybody else in the country. The only problem, though, is that Paul Ryan's rhetoric doesn't necessarily match his voting record. I think a lot of people would be surprised to know that he only got a 71% on the club's scorecard last year, and that his overall rating, his lifetime rating, is 86. Now, 86% isn't bad, but it's not good either. He voted for a lot of the big spending bills during the Bush years. He voted for TARP, the Wall Street bailout. He's voted for a lot of pro-union bills, And like you said, he just orchestrated the Ryan Murray deal, which unwound a lot of the spending cuts that we had already agreed to. So there are, unfortunately, far more blemishes on his record than I think people are aware of.
Talking with Andy Roth of the Club for Growth. And Andy, you mentioned before that the end of the sequestration cuts might not seem that huge right now, but when you factor in future years, the number gets pretty high. Any estimation overall how much additional spending we're going to see as a result of the erasing of most of sequestration?
No, we don't know. But what we do know is that we never know what the next year's Congress is going to do. The Congress in 2015 and 2016 are not bound by the decisions made in 2014. That's why when they make these deals to promise cuts over 10 years, they are very empty promises, because it's almost a 100% certainty that Congress will find those cuts unbearable. And that's why we opposed the debt ceiling increase in 2011, is because we knew that they would never live up to that promise. And we're finding out just a few years later that they are indeed breaking that promise.
One of the other arguments that the House Republican I spoke with earlier in the week made, and I've heard this many other places as well, and as I know you have as well, and that's that, well, Republicans control the House. The Democrats have the White House. The Democrats have the Senate. And there's only so much the Republicans can insist upon given the current dynamics. And until the party wins more elections, they just can't demand what most in the party would like to see in bills like this. What's your reaction to that?
That's kind of like surrendering before a fight. The House is the only chamber that has the power of the purse, because they're the ones that start the ball rolling on all of these appropriations bills. They have leverage. Now, they don't have an enormous amount of leverage, but they do have leverage. And one of it is just to let the current law continue. And I think whoever said that they only have one half of one branch, I think they're actually being too favorable to the GOP. The truth is that there are some in the Republican Party who would prefer to side with Democrats, and that's why they broke the sequester, is because there was too many Republicans who wanted to increase spending with the Democrats. Had the Republican Party been in lockstep, in unison, to keep the sequester, then I think we would have been in a totally different scenario right now, and in a lot better scenario. But unfortunately, that's not the case.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the defense spending and the sequestration. How much of that do you think was a factor in Republicans deciding, at least those who voted for the bill, in rolling back sequestration? I know there's a lot of frustration about that. And how much of the new spending do you think will end up there?
Well, the conventional wisdom is that Republicans didn't like the spending cuts in defense, and Democrats didn't like the spending cuts in non-defense. So they got together and plussed up both sides of that ledger. I think that's entirely correct. Now, how many Republicans didn't like the defense cuts, I think is an open question, but I think that there were enough to make this deal happen, and that's why it did.
Do you think there was any legitimate interest on the right to rework sequestration? In other words, keep the parameters, keep the numbers in place, but maybe change where the cuts come from?
I think that there was a lot of interest to do that, but I don't think that there was any path to victory to do that. I don't think that there's any combination of votes between Republicans and Democrats where you could orchestrate that outcome. So the only two outcomes or to keep the sequester as it is, or unwind it the way that they did. And unfortunately, they took the wrong path.
Andy, we'll leave it there. Thank you very much for your time today. We appreciate your analysis.